from West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Support for the legislature today is provided by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Learn more at aarp.org/WV. The Charleston Gazette Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts, keeping you in the know while you're on the go. Lumos Networks, online at lumosnetworks.com. Marshall University, with more than 100 degree programs offered in 4 locations and online. More about the Marshall family at marshall.edu. Orion Strategies, professional public relations, government affairs, creative services, and research and polling, with offices in Charleston, Buchanan, Martinsburg, Pittsburgh, and Columbus.
Good evening and welcome to the Legislature Today. It's the year of the child here at the Capitol. We'll have a conversation later in the program about the impact of the drug crisis on West Virginia's children. But first, senior reporter Dave Mistich joins me for an update on some of the major stories we've been following. Dave, welcome to the show.
Again, thanks.
When we signed off of the broadcast last night, the Senate Committee of the Whole was still going through the bill, then there was testimony, and tomorrow the bill is on amendment stage. So there's been a lot in the last 24 hours. Fill in the gaps, bring us up to date.
That's right. Well, today the Committee of the Whole met again. Not a lot of action, not a lot of movement, virtually no discussion of the bill, no amendments. They did clear the bill out of committee on an 18-16 vote. Once they passed that out of committee, they voted again to bring the bill to first reading, and that was again an 18-16 vote. The two Republicans dissenting that we've heard all along are Senators Bill Hamilton and Kenny Mann. They were again the two Republicans that joined Democrats on these votes. I spoke to Senator Craig Blair, who was the chairman of the Committee of the Whole, also chairs Finance, a big proponent of this bill, and asked him specifically about those two senators and the way they've been voting, and here's what Senator Blair had to say.
Maybe they feel uncomfortable. You'd have to ask them that on that. But they're voting for their constituents and what they believe is the right thing to do. And we've recognized that. I see no animosity in the members of our caucus on what's going on and how we're managing things at all. We're a team.
Right. And lastly, I mean, you just see this bill, you know, passing 18-16. What do you see it, you know? I presume Monday will be a final vote, correct?
Monday should be a final vote, then it'll go to the House of Delegates. I hope the House of Delegates gives it a thorough vetting and that they, obviously I want them to pass it out and get it to the governor for that. And if the governor vetoes it, well, then we have an opportunity to override his veto. If it passes both chambers, I would say that there's a real good possibility that there'll be an override of the governor's veto.
And, you know, Senator Blair talking about, you know, it going over the House. Yesterday we got a statement from House Speaker Roger Hanshaw, kind of non-committal as far as the House's position, aside from the commitment to pay raises and funding for PEIA, which would be separate from this bill. The pay raises are in this bill, though. But, you know, a lot of questions over, you know, where the bill goes from here if it does pass, you know, potentially Monday. But also a lot of questions about this gubernatorial override, the veto override. We're hearing a lot about that because the governor has come out, you know, with a lot of issues with this bill. I spoke also with Democratic Senator Mike Romano today of Harrison County. Here's what he had to say about some of the issues with the bill, but also he spoke to the two Republicans that have been sort of dissenting from their party on Senate Bill 451.
I've been here 5 years. I've watched them march in lockstep when people were voting for things on their side, but they didn't even believe in. I don't think we're going to be very Much of an opportunity to peel off one or two more votes would be necessary to stop it. I give Senator Mann and Senator Hamilton the greatest amount of credit because they had the courage to stand up to their caucus and vote against this bad bill. And I think if you talk to anybody, you know, no teacher's been consulted, no superintendent's been consulted, the school board wasn't consulted. They've just rolled this out from a template that's put out there nationally by these national charter school organizations. We've seen the same bill for the last 5 years. We defeated it the four previous ones, but this time they're marching in lockstep, and I don't think they're going to stop it. And one of the reasons is because they put it all in one bill with the teacher pay raise that's so desperately needed. They put it all in one bill, you know, with the other changes, some good changes that need to be done to the school system, because they're hoping that they can push the whole thing out just as it is, and nobody will try to stop it because they don't want to stop the pay raise. That's bad politics.
And again, today we saw a lot of teachers around the Senate chamber. You know, a lot of questions about whether or not this bill is going to pass. I mean, I think given the history of the votes, the procedural sort of action on this bill, it's likely to pass if it does just by the skin of its teeth. Probably going to see that 18-16 margin if it does pass. A lot of talk, again, with teachers, the next move on all this. You know, we're hearing that the unions are possibly, or at least talking about putting together a statewide meeting. I heard from a teacher today from Work County who said that, you know, their reps are talking to them, keeping them in close contact. All the teachers basically keeping their eye on this, seeing what the Senate does with it to make their next move on what to do with this bill.
All right, now over in the House, the huge foster care bill, House Bill 2010, passed out of the House, but not before a lot of back and forth. It's been a very controversial bill. It's a $225 million contract for a managed care company. Let's take a listen to some of the debate back and forth this morning.
This doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't even start to solve the problem, but it is starting. Well, little lead way, Speaker. I have a black trash bag. I won't unfold it. Excuse me. But that is what most foster care children use as a suitcase, a black trash bag, when they go from one home to another home.
DHHR is a behemoth, and we need to deal with that. It is ineffective in so many ways across the state, and we as a body need to take that on. I feel very strongly about that. It doesn't work. It's been broken for as long as I've been working, over 35 years. But that aside, I am reluctantly going to vote for this bill because I need to go with my head on this one. We need to try something different and see if it works.
Where are the children voices in this? I became a godmother to a child that's in a foster to adopt program. And the hell that she has gone through being in this system, it's disgusting, it's disgraceful, and it's disrespectful. For us to have a bill and not have the people that care for these children day in and day out, not even be welcome at the table, and this is the first time that they hear of this, it's preposterous.
This is just one option. It's not the cure-all. We've never proposed that. I'd have perfect bill on the top of it if that was what was going on. But we all know that that never happens. But it is a step in the right direction for a population of kids. And it is also a step in the right direction to bring some kids back to our state.
And that bill passed 67-32 and now comes over to the Senate. Dave, you were at the House Banking and Insurance meeting this morning.
Actually, I wasn't in there, but I followed along outside of it and caught up with Chair Eric Nelson on House Bill 2538. That's the banking fix to the state's medical cannabis program. He explained the need for that bill, and, you know, again, it did pass this committee. But again, here's Chairman Eric Nelson from the House Banking and Insurance Committee.
You know, 33 other states have this. There's no one specific model that has been in place through all 33 states. In ours here, it does allow a third party to come in. And if a third party comes in, they'll have to have a substantial collateral base to protect that cash. So currently, we will not see regular banking institutions in play because the federal guidelines prohibit federally insured institutions like banks with FDIC insurance and the Federal Reserve from participating in this.
Then again, that was House Banking and Insurance Chair Eric Nelson. There was an amendment to that bill in committee, that reinstated a provision that would protect state employees at the treasurer's office. That provision had been taken out of the bill before it hit committee and then went back in and as an amendment. Delegate Isaac Spinago, a Democrat, he offered that amendment and it did clear the committee. So we'll have a take a look at his explanation of what that amendment does.
I think we owe it to our public employees when we pass laws, and there could be a conflict between state and federal, and if they go after our public employees, that we're going to defend them and stand by them. I just think we have an obligation to do that, irrespective. Maybe those individuals don't agree with the bill that we're passing, but they're going to be good troopers and do what they're told, mandated by the lawmakers, so we need to stand up for them. So, and the treasurer's office requested this, or had very much concern, because the treasurer's looking after his employees as well when they go to implement this.
Teachers, students, and child advocates are here today meeting with lawmakers about how the opioid crisis is affecting youth throughout the state. Assistant News Director Glynis Board will host that discussion in just a moment, but first, Randy Yowie has this report.
I have a couple family members who are addicted right now, and I live with my grandma because when I was born, my mother was on drugs.
Liza Kelly stayed straight. Liza joined in a presentation aimed to bring young voices to the attention of legislative decision makers. One resounding theme, both here and now under debate on the House and Senate floor, a student demand to expand counseling and mental health services in West Virginia schools.
They talked a lot about, you know, how could we help support our teachers, put more counselors, put more social workers in the schools.
As of right now, our school, it only has one counselor, and we have 400 students, and that's not a good ratio. Also, I believe it's better that we get rehab specialists in schools because many people affected by the opioid crisis are teenagers.
Then there's a prevention and protection program aimed at preschoolers and kindergartners.
In fighting the opioid crisis between now and May, thousands of children will learn the pros and cons about my good buddy Rex here. Hi Rex, say hello to the folks out there. He's such a pill.
In both live and interactive animation form, Rex the RX's message is simple. Cap him, know him, and throw him. Especially directed to the many little ones forced by pill abuse to live with elder foster parents and grandparents.
They're the fastest growing group of individuals for opioid prescriptions, and unfortunately they're also the least likely to store their medications properly. So the goal is to use Rex if you need him, but when you're done with him, you don't want to keep Rex around.
From Tots to Teens, Year of the Child Coalition members are working to steer at-risk kids towards safer lives and healthier outcomes. For the Legislature Today, I'm Randy Yowie at the Capitol.
I'm Glynis Board, Assistant News Director with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Joining me this evening, Felicia Bush, founder and CEO of the nonprofit Harmony Mental Health, and a founding member of Handle With Care. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. So I can't help but commenting that in the background of us here tonight, we can hear a rally here in the Capitol, and it's the Our Students First rally. Can you hear? We've been listening
yes.
to them.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of these teachers are really upset with this omnibus bill. And, you know, they say that West Virginia is a poor state, unlike other states, like, I don't know, Idaho, other states, and that divesting in an already poorly funded public education is kind of bound to exacerbate issues that schools face. And they say that the real barrier to academic achievement is increasingly the number of students in classrooms who are traumatized as a result of the opioid crisis, so they're calling for support. What's your reaction to that? What would you say to teachers who say we need more support in the classroom?
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. In our work with teachers, with the Department of Health and Human Resources, through our agency, and through the Handle With Care program, what we know is that children who are traumatized, you know, their ability to learn is impacted, severely impacted. And until you can create safety for these children, until you can create some sort of normalcy and acceptance, learning just isn't on the table. And so these teachers have every right to be upset. They have every right to be demanding support, mm-hmm. because these are not the children that they went to school to teach. They learned how to teach when they went to school. And you know, they need the supports from our legislators, from our communities, in order to help them help our children.
Right. Well, this organization, West Virginia's for Affordable Healthcare, they held roundtables all mm-hmm. over the state. I don't know if you were involved.
Yes.
And one of the discussion points that really came from that series was a call for trauma-informed care. And I know that you are an expert in this field, especially in this state. And so I was just wondering, can you just explain what trauma-informed means to folks who don't know?
Well, I don't know that I'm an expert, but I certainly have experience on a daily basis and working with children who've experienced trauma and the fallout from that. Trauma-informed care is a framework for providing services to an individual in a way that is respectful and sensitive to what they have experienced. Mm-hmm. And it requires systems from our education systems to our child protective systems to our mental health systems to change the way we've done things so that we create an environment. This isn't a program, there's no binder. There's, you know, you don't go to a training and then you come back and then you put that on the shelf and you've got it. This is changing your culture so that it is safe for everyone, so that it is empathic, so that it builds empathy, so that it creates an environment where children, whether they have been traumatized or not, can flourish. Mm-hmm. And our reality is that we all experience trauma in one form or another at some point in our lives. Mm-hmm. And we must have the tools to deal with that trauma. Right. What this crisis has done is we have a generation of children who don't have that connection to a caring parent in their formative years that's required for us to function, for us to be resilient in life. Mm-hmm. And so that has to be provided for them. And these children are hitting our preschools and our kindergarten, our first grades. You know, they're being suspended from school at that age, if you can imagine.
No.
Yes, it is the last statistic I had is the highest rate of suspensions is kindergarten.
What?
And I deal with this, in every day, in my therapists throughout the counties that we work in, the school systems that we work in, we're managing crises constantly, and we're expecting educators in this environment to be able to educate, and it's unreasonable. It's an unreasonable expectation.
That's remarkable. Now, so your organization, Harmony Mental Health, you're in 6 counties in mm-hmm. West Virginia.
Yes.
And you're implementing this kind of training throughout these counties. Tell me a little bit more about that and what that looks like.
What we do. Yes, we provide trauma-informed care training, so how to create a trauma-informed environment. And we provide that to whoever asks, counties across the state, county boards of education, individual schools, individual classrooms. And we do that because it's important for educators, for systems to understand the impact of trauma on the brain, on a child's brain, and how that is then going to impact their ability to learn, their ability to trust, their ability to respond, to what we consider to be help, and they consider to be a threat. And so they need to understand that this is not the child that you went to school to teach. It's not the classroom of 20 years ago.
Right.
And the child that you're dealing with is dealing with so much more that is so basic that it interferes with their ability to learn.
We're really talking about brain science here.
Absolutely.
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 So from what I understand, in those very formative years, even I can get connecting and all these other...
Right. Attachment is critical. Right.
And if you don't have it, it changes the way you process
life. The world.
Right?
The world. It changes your view of the world. So instead of, we generally have a view of the world as a safe place. Even as we see horrors around us, our general assumption is that most people are good and the world is generally safe. But for a traumatized child, their perception is the world is not safe. I'm not safe. And so the first tenet of trauma-informed care is creating safety. Mm. But the reality is it has to start from, the upper echelons. It has to start at the top, because if you don't feel safe, you can't create safety for others.
Oh, wow.
And so if our superintendents don't feel safe because they have all of these requirements to meet and, you know, all of this on them to, you know, they must accomplish these test scores, et cetera. If they don't feel safe, if they don't feel like they work in an environment that is trauma-informed, that is respectful of what they're experiencing, they can't create that for principals. Principals can't create it for teachers, and teachers can't create it for students.
Wow, so you're helping all of these.
We're trying.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, you know, it was discussed during interims and then earlier today, mm-hmm. as well in the House, they're talking about funding that would infuse schools with counselors and therapists. And I just wonder, would just filling those positions, will that help mitigate the problems that we're seeing with trauma, right. in and of itself,
well,
those positions?
Absolutely, you need workforce. You need bodies to do the work. However, if they don't have the proper training and they don't have the proper supports, then all you're doing is further pathologizing a system that's already not working. We know it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so they need that trauma-informed care, that trauma-informed system. Teachers need to feel cared for so that they can care for other people, mm-hmm. so that they can care for our students. And so, yes, we do need the workforce, but it has to be properly trained. And it has to happen in, you know, our higher education. We have teachers going to, you know, getting their master's degrees right now who will come out without information about trauma. And these are the students that they're going to face. We have therapists, we have counselors and social workers and psychologists, and they all work for Harmony. They're my coworkers, mm-hmm. Who are in their training now, who accessing that kind of training is an elective and often a very expensive elective. And so it's not something, but these are the students that are and the clients that they're going to be dealing with. And so our higher education has to address the issue. Mm-hmm. Each of our systems has to address the issue, or you're going to face burnout and turnover, and that's what's plagued us, you know, in particularly in this state. We simply can't afford it. Our children can't afford it. They can't afford to wait for us to get our act together.
Well, that is the big question. I mean, it's really unclear whether or not there's going to be legislation that comes through to help fund increased positions, let alone trauma-informed policies. Right. What do you think needs to happen? I mean, what if this doesn't happen? What if the legislature doesn't come through? What will that mean for our schools right now?
Well, it will mean the situation that's already untenable is just going to be exacerbated. Mm-hmm. It means that you're going to have good teachers who are, you know, they're doing the work that they want to do for the reason, you know, for the right reasons, that are going to burn out. People need to feel like they are competent at what they are doing in right. order to be happy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you feel like you don't have the training that you need and you don't have the support that you need so that you can reach that child, you don't feel competent.
Right.
And then you become discontent.
Mm-hmm.
And what unfortunately happens is the people who shouldn't be in that position in the first place, they're the ones who stay. And the good people are the ones who leave.
Oh, wow.
Right? And so, you know, we all in every profession have people who should be doing that profession and some who should be selling some shoes or something like that. Okay. And so we want to keep good people. And so we have to find whether the legislature, you know, and I hope that they'll do what's right for our children. I pray that they'll do what's right for our children. You know, in the absence of that, then they cannot punish these children for not having the supports they need in order to function in society. And they need to understand that the fallout from that is, you know, it's not just one or two children in a classroom. We've always had traumatized children in our classroom.
Mm-hmm.
It's overwhelming that some children are preventing other children from learning. It's not just the traumatized child who's not learning. It's your child who's sitting beside them that's not learning
and
because
can
it's
you,
interrupted.
Speaking of interrupted, mm-hmm. can you describe for me in a little more detail what kind of interruptions we're talking about in the classroom? What does that look like?
Oh, I can give you a week in the life of Harmony therapists. We've been called in because we've had children strangling other children, children kicking, punching teachers. We've had, and these are children who are hurt. You know, the reality is hurt people hurt people. And when children haven't been given the attention that they needed when they were infants, and I'm talking about throughout pre-K and kindergarten. Mm-hmm. These kind of behaviors, this physical aggression, just disruptive behaviors that prevent themselves and other people from learning. And when people, when they can't get the supports that they need, when they're children, children make bids for attention.
Right.
And when they're met, children thrive. And when they're not, they don't, and they stop bidding for attention.
So very, very briefly, trauma-informed, these therapies, they actually, you've seen them work?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, I've seen them work.
Awesome.
But it takes it takes a village. It takes everyone. It takes trauma-informed, trauma-trained therapists. It takes trauma-informed systems.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in and for talking with us and sharing your story and sharing stories like this. I think it's such an important issue that we face very much. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, this concludes tonight's broadcast of the Legislature Today from the State Capitol Building. I'm Glynis Board, and from everyone here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thanks for joining us and have a great evening.